You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. My guest in the studio is Ken Simon, author of Pizza Face, or The Hero of Suburbia, recently published by Grove Weidenfeld. Good part of my enjoyment of this book came from my enjoyment of a certain kind of book that I read when I was growing up. Some of them were by Beverly Cleary. Some of them were by Max Schulman, like The Adventures of Dobie Gillis. And this struck me as being a kind of astonishing novel for geeks. What were your examples in constructing this amazing adolescent Andy with his case of terminal acne and his fear of everything?
Michael, I had no examples and I had no influences. Growing up, I didn't read much. In high school, we weren't encouraged to read books. We were encouraged to memorize vocabulary words for the SATs. When we were given books, in the rare instances that we were given books to read, we weren't told to write about them or discuss them. We were told to create art projects for them. In other words, it'd be read Huckleberry Finn and then make a poster or create a skit about Huckleberry Finn. So since I wasn't artistic in the sense of drawing or making poster board, I always thought I had no aptitude in literature. So growing up, my artistic influences are more television. I watched Saturday Night Live and Mary Hartman. I didn't start reading until I moved to New York like 5 years ago. So I have a lot of writing to catch up on. I think writing is a lot more about obsession, though, than about literary influences. It's a first novel, so of course it's very autobiographical. And I had my own skin problems, and I had my own obsession with beauty, so it came very naturally.
When I was in school, I remember coming home from college to a bar, and I'd never been in a bar in my hometown at all. And I saw there someone who knew me through junior high and high school, and he said, "God, I can't believe you're still alive." I said, "Why?" He said, "Boy, did they used to rag on you all the time.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have survived it if I were you." And that's why reading Pizza Face was, you know, kind of a revelation. It's not often that the worm turns and writes a book and doesn't mind talking about it.
Well, that's, again, when you say what are your influences, the scariest thing I ever did is once I was tripping on acid in college. I was tripping on acid. I had a hard complexion. I was wearing makeup to cover it up. And on the acid trip, I looked at myself closely in the mirror. And I said, "God, Ken, you really do look bad." And I've always had this obsession with beautiful, with beauty. Either I'm trying to figure out whether it's to possess it myself or to have someone who is beautiful. And so for me to look in myself at the mirror and confront myself was the scariest thing, and it could prompt, as your friend suggested, could make you kill yourself. But I think by doing that, by hitting bottom in that way, it gave me the strength not only to go on but the courage to write about it. Once you've faced yourself, this is where I think good writing is about honesty. Obviously it's about writing well, but it's about honesty, and I think it's about obsession.
I think of this really, you know, you describe the fears in this book as coming from inside, but I, you know, this is a whole crowd of people, you know, calling you Pizza Face, and what are the names in the course
of... Oh, God, there's Monster Face, there's a number of people, there's Crisco Head, Camelback, Beauty Queen, a number of just the Glob, Prong, I'm just thinking of all these wacky high school and college names we had. But I think, no, there was that level of abuse, and I think that level of abuse is inevitable. But most of my torment, because I speak about myself because I am the character in the book for all practical purposes. Most of the hardest things for me, I could deal with the torment. It wasn't pleasant, but the hardest thing was the inner turmoil. The turmoil of wanting to be beautiful and not. It made it a lot harder when it's being reinforced at school, But I found it. What makes hopefully the book more interesting is the external struggle. But speaking for myself, the harder was the internal struggle. The mm-hmm. hardest continues to be the internal struggle.
Does writing help it?
It's the only thing to do. It doesn't resolve it. The obsessions remain the same, regardless of how much plastic surgery one has. The obsession remains the same. It's the only thing I can do. It's the only thing I know how to do. I can't drive a car. I can't wait tables. So there's no choice in the matter. It's not, oh, you write to feel better. You write because, gosh, it's the only thing you can do. It's the only thing I can do.
What about people who don't write? Well, I mean, it seems to me the interesting thing about this book is, you know, that it takes into a novel a level of suffering that I've only seen in adolescent books for adolescents. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very odd, but, you know, there is a whole genre that many people skip over of books that are about the pain of dating mm-hmm. or the pain of being taken to a Chinese restaurant by a date when you've never had Chinese food. And, mm-hmm. As soon as I hit that in this book, the character's desire not to be taken to a Chinese restaurant because he might have to use chopsticks, yeah. I said, oh, yeah,
If you go out to a Chinese restaurant with a truly gracious Chinese person, because I'm a klutz, so I once went to a fancy Chinese restaurant with this Chinese writer, Nian Cheng, and she's such a gracious woman. She used a fork so everyone else could use a fork. I thought that was a true aristocrat.
Very great elegance.
Very elegant, yeah. So,
did you find yourself starting and stopping in this book? Because I've spoken to people who read Pizza Face by Ken Simon, recently published by Grove, who tell me that at times, although the book is very funny, at times they've put it down for a couple of days because the pain is equally enormous.
Oh, gosh. It wasn't painful for me at all. Again, maybe by facing the pain and feeling it and bottoming out with it, it gave me not courage, because, I mean, again, it's not courage. It allowed me to do this without feeling that pain. Again, I feel I'm distant enough from the character that I can write about this. I've already experienced the pain. I'm over it. I'm over it, Michael. I'm over it. I'm fine. I'm not bitter. I'm just glad I didn't videotape myself then. I'm glad there are no videotapes of myself from back then. But I really think I'm over it in a lot of ways.
One of the things that reviewers have noticed in kind of admiration for the book is that although the hero is gay, that is underplayed. His concern is with his acne.
Yeah. Well, John Waters said something I thought that was kind of profound. He said he thinks fat people have it a lot harder in contemporary culture than gay people. And I think that's true. I'm gay, and the guy in the book is gay, but I think this is much more, as you said, an ugly novel. Again, and part of the reason that is because this character isn't having sex, so it's not a sexual novel. I mean, his concern is being able to sit next to someone without their getting up and leaving. I mean, sex is out of the question. So therefore, that's part of the reason I think it's easier for straight reviewers and straight people to enjoy, quite frankly, because there is not gay sex in it, really. I mean, there's a little bit of pawing, but the guy can have sex because no one wants to have sex with him because his acne is so bad. That's why. No, he can't have sex, therefore there isn't sex in the book. It's not avoiding sex, or I didn't purposely do that so to make it more digestible for reviewers.
No, but there's also, you know, there were many novels, I think there still are, in which the dominant tone would be, oh God, and I'm gay on top of all the rest of it.
Well, I think it's great to be gay. I'm not proud to be gay. That's why I didn't go to the march, because I'm not this, you know, gay pride. I'm not proud to be gay. But I think being gay is so helpful because you can indulge your fantasies a lot straighter, a lot easier than if you're a straight man. If you're a gay man, you're allowed to indulge this aesthetic obsession a lot. It's a lot easier for you to do it than if you are straight. So I think I'm gay. It's not gay on top of that. I'm gay. Thank God I'm gay. Yeah. I think it's made my life much easier. In terms of writing, in terms of meeting other writers, in terms of living in New York City, I think it's a gift. Tell that to my mother, okay? Can we call her? No, it's not gay. I don't look at it that way at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that's what is expected. In fact, this character, Andy, seems relatively at ease with his sexuality. And I guess the play of his enormous fear of himself and his body physically, coupled with his knowing what and who he is what makes him such a sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope so. I don't know. Again, I think part of the reason, I don't know how comfortable he is, because he's not allowed to confront his sexuality, because again, no one really wants to have sex with him. So I think there's part of himself that he has to shut off. So in that sense, he's not fully developed. If a fully developed person means a person who's having enjoyable sex, then he's not fully developed.
Well,
but I don't know. Is that
there's a scene, for instance, in which, having an elegant calligraphy, he enjoys the parade column in the local newspaper, and he likes to imitate the italics. He notices in that column a letter, wondering whether there are as many gay linemen working for the phone company as there are on football teams, and he traces the author of the letter, and in fact he meets the author at a button convention, a political button convention, and I thought that he was very brave to go out and meet a stranger via letter in a place he's never been. And, you know, I don't think of him, I don't think of someone who's got hang-ups. I mean, he's very hungry. He's got an appetite.
Yeah.
Many people who are terrified like that become, what is that word that Woody Allen used when he was first making Annie Hall? Anhedonia. They lose desire.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a book that's full of, you know, desire,
longing,
and yearning.
Longing and desire. Unfulfilled longing, unfulfilled desires. That's, and I think, a gift of, again, acknowledging an obsession you can never have is that you will always be filled with this longing. And I think that sustains me, and it sustains the character in the book, is this longing for what you can't have but want, and will continue the pursuit, even though you realize you can't have it. Is that insanity, though? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I think it is comforting. Someone once said to me that the question to ask when you saw someone you were attracted to was whether you wanted to sleep with that person or whether you wanted to look like that
person. Oh, exactly. That's it right there. Especially, I think, if you're gay. It'll be a lot more interesting for how straight people feel about that. I'm fascinated to see how two heterosexual roommates, if one is much better looking than the other, what's the dynamic there? I mean, these are questions I'm always asking myself.
Well, it is also a community that places an enormous premium.
But I think everyone does. Again, it's easier for gays to indulge that premium, but I think the obsession is universal. It's easier to indulge if you're gay, but I think everyone is interested in beauty.
Well, I think that may be true, but at the same time, you know, where I come from, which is a neighborhood in Queens, you know, many of us are children of immigrants. And there's a lot of the Eastern European look, people who look sort of like roots or twisted up, gnarled, a tendency toward a stoop.
Mm-hmm.
And after living in L.A., which is the home of, you know,
all the top models, all the top models in the world, and they come here and they copulate, so forth, so on. And they look beautiful here. Everyone here is so beautiful. God.
I decided to move into the Fairfax area, where people look the way I looked when, the way they looked when I was growing up. And all around me I see people who are paired and happily paired, who are like nowhere within the realm of beauty. I don't think beauty even enters the category. Comfort, companionability, the ability to have a good argument, maybe even some weird kind of sadomasochistic relationship. But beauty, you know, beauty bailed out light years before birth. It wasn't part of the genetic chain. And, you know, it's real interesting to, in the middle of, you know, Hollywood, where there is so much swank, to find people who are utterly indifferent to it.
I don't think anyone is truly utterly indifferent to it. I think to do that, you're shutting off part of your mind to be indifferent to it. I'm not saying that you have to have a obviously, I mean, I have to make this clear that you have to have a maid who's beautiful. I'm just saying everyone has to have an interest to it. To not be interested in it, you have to close your eyes, not to have an interest in it, not to acknowledge its presence or its power.
Well, I think this is why people...
And you had to make a conscious choice to find this era. You had to say, I want to live in this way amongst these people.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It was a conscious pursuit to not see certain things.
Yeah, but I think also one of the resources of people who are not themselves beautiful has been the praise of beauty. There have been many, you know, ugly poets who are great appreciators mm-hmm. and celebrators of beauty.
I think if you always have been beautiful, you have no idea. I think have to be aware of the power you have over others, but I don't think you're truly aware of the power of it until you've never had it. Probably the most powerful thing, I was talking to someone the other day, would be if you were once beautiful and lost it. I think that person probably knows more than anyone how powerful beauty is.
Do you know any such people?
I know someone who was beautiful in high school and then broke out terribly in college and wanted to commit suicide. It was so painful. Just went into hiding for several years and then had, you know, some chemical peels, a few Calgon treatments, and now they're fine.
Is this a very superficial concern? I mean, if it can be corrected by a few skin peels and collagen treatments, I mean...
No, because it's an obsession. You're talking about what motivates her. I guess what motivates people day to day, I mean, obviously the most important things are intellectual curiosity, decency to each other, and the pursuit of love. These are I think there are certain basic, decent things that we have to do as humans, and that's be kind and try to find someone to fall in love with. But I also, as I write, I try to figure out why am I obsessed with this and where is this obsession coming from? Because people are saying, Ken, quit talking about pretty boys. This is a bore. These people don't interest you. You have nothing in common with them. They're, you know, younger than you are. You're just going to be bored and empty. And it's true. I'm not talking about trying to date beautiful people or how to win a date with a beautiful person, or I'm not talking about hanging out in front of beautiful people's homes. I'm just trying to understand the power they have over me, and I think the power they have over a lot of people. And I'm saying that it's a good thing. It's a good thing to acknowledge the power of beauty. That's all.
Yeah. I've been talking to Ken Simon, the author of Pizza Face or The Hero of Suburbia, recently published by Grove Weidenfeld, and thank you for coming and being with us
thanks
today.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Sir.
Next guest is Bruce Wagner, author of Force Majeure. Majeure? How do you say this?
Majeure.
Majeure. Published by Random House. I first met Bruce up in San Francisco at an occasion when Jean-Luc Godard and Pauline Kael were going to be interviewing one another. This was presented in the book as a debate. It became an exercise in non-confrontation, some kind of Zen thing, and controversy is what Bruce has specialized in since, leading finally to this book, an apocalyptic fantasia on the themes inspired by screenwriting, hackdom, fame, and Los Angeles. Well, this emerges from Hegira, from the small press to the large press. What brought the book into our hands?
You mean how did it?
It was once short stories.
Yeah, it was slimly produced.
A
friend of mine, Caldecott Chubb, who works in the movie business now and used to publish art books, actually William Eggleston's, some of his private editions of his work, decided to publish an edition of 1,000 copies of the stories, and they achieved some notoriety, and from the little book. I got a bigger deal for Random House. With Random House, it was going to be a book of short stories, but I decided, why bother? You know, with short stories. I mean, I love short stories, but in this case, these four stories were originally a kind of exercise that I'd done to see simply if I could do it. And then I thought, I don't want to write an endless series of stories that end with a kind of frisson of humiliation, you know, a kind of, you know, O. Henry type stories with where the screenwriter gets a gut punch. To me, it was that was not so interesting. Much more interesting to me would be to attempt a novel, which is what I ultimately did.
You like things once they become crazed.
I'm sorry?
You like things once they become crazed.
Yeah, I find that that when you reach that just beyond the pale of sort of our everyday activity is that panic moment, you know, and that moment to me is a transcendent moment because you can pull a lot of things at that moment that you couldn't pull, you know, if you weren't in a frightened kind of fatal, you know, mortal mode. You know what I mean? So I do. Once I reach that kind of epiphany, you know, I dig that because then unexpected things come to me.
A friend of mine pointed out that although you'd barely notice it, the first three words of Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust typify the book. The first three words are "around quitting time." Todd Hackett put his papers in the drawer, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. And in a certain way, all of these progressive spiralings of self-destruction, humiliation in the book do take place around quitting time, but it's later in the day. Could you describe the descent into the pit post Nathaniel West?
Let's see. I don't. You know, I. My terrifying confession is that I have never read Nathaniel West. I mean, I'm sort of a spotty illiterate, you know, because I have a problem reading. I find that, you know, it's like those who don't stammer when they sing or when they swim or when they have sex. I'm best when I tackle a book that's over 1,000 pages. So you put me with, you know, Bleak House or Don Quixote and I'm okay, but I have an enormous difficulty reading, period. But as far as quitting time, I would say for Bud Wiggins that phrase is sort of poignant to me, quitting time, you know. And for him, there's a kind of quitting time that has a kind of sweet pathos for him, and I associate it with the evening also. You know, there's this long section of the book called Wild Psalms, which originally I was going to call the book Wild Psalms, and my editor said, "Boy, we like Force Majeure; it's such a strong title," and I ultimately did like it too. So I didn't feel I was capitulating, but this section that takes place for Bud, where he meets a rabbi at an airport who's a Holocaust survivor impersonator, that to me is all quitting time. That's mm-hmm. all evening and all people that are spent, people that are fraudulent, but in a way that's not malevolent, you know. And it's weird. I don't mean to digress, but when I think about it, very few people discuss, maybe only one or two critics have called attention to that section, because everyone is obsessed with the book as being about Hollywood and as a Roman clay so I find that, you know, we were talking earlier, I guess before we were taping, about people who read and people who don't, or people that come up to me and say they've read my book, and because it's the first time anyone, a period of my life where people have been coming up to me and telling me they've read a book because I've never written a book before, I always want to say, well, did you really read it? You know?
I'm talking to Bruce Wagner, the author of Force Majeure from Random House. Tell me, what kind of person, in your inimitable way, becomes a screenwriter?
Someone with a death wish. I mean, someone asked me once about this book. They said, do you think that this will put people off? And I said, no, it's a recruitment manual. I think, I think it's exciting to be, the idea of being a screenwriter, it still has a kind of smoky drama surrounding it, I think, you know. It's one of those things that you tell people, and people ask you what you do, and you say, I'm a screenwriter, at least outside of this town. And, oh, really? You know, it's that sort of... So I think what lures people is a kind of drama and a kind of fatuous belief that they will be able to control their destiny mm-hmm. and the destiny of actors and others. I think the love of movies is the initial draw. And then you decide what you're going to specialize in. You know, it's like you decide you want to be a doctor, then you have to take 4 years to decide, well, do I want to be a psychiatrist or do I want to be a dermatologist or a pathologist? You know what I mean? And people try screenwriting, you know. And then they decide, no, I can't do this. And they go back to Canada or wherever they came from. Or they become a producer or a line producer, you know. So the attraction is, I think, the movies still, you know, just the movies.
What I particularly like and what made me think about Nathaniel West is that the language in this book seems phosphorescent and flat at the same time. There's a kind of nice, low-level fever grittiness about it. Would come from Nathaniel West if you'd read him. But where else? Lenny Bruce, I think, too, you know.
Well, I tell you, I don't know. I guess the book is a weird admixture of the kind of almost Baroque and the deadpan, you know, which is where my sort of sensibilities lie. I think that's pretty accurate. It's funny. Some one critic said that Wagner writes like a screenwriter who's so relieved that he doesn't have to adhere to the rigors of the screenwriting form, you know, as if I got sort of drunk and, you know, went out on a toot and you know. But for my character, I mean, the book, Wiggins vacillates between a kind of normalcy or the normalcy that he... perceives, his perception of normalcy and sanity and sobriety and stability, to the most brazen, hallucinogenic, psychosis ultimately. He vacillates between these two states. So I felt I had to do the same stylistically, you know.
I've been talking to Bruce Wagner, the author of Force Majeure, recently published by Random House. Thank you for joining us, Bruce.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.